We are starting part three of this mini series, and stop sharing for 1 second so I can see everybody. So what we've dealt with over the last couple of sessions is sort of a part one and part two, which was a general introduction to the world of Agadic Midrashim and how to understand the world of the language of Chazal in a kind of philosophical or lessons or ideals or values or principles, but not necessarily as a kind of a pshat, to separate the world of pshat and the world of drash, and also recognizing that Chazal, who span a period of 1,000 years of rabbinic literature, are not writing or reflecting in their midrashic analysis of the text, Masoret or traditions that came from Har Sinai, but rather their own personal insights into their understanding of the text, whether it be literal or homiletic. That was sort of our first unit. We saw sources related to the Gaonim and the Rishonim and the Achronim, all in that regard. Our second unit took us a little bit deeper into the domain of Midrashic analysis, and that was in particular with regards to Rashi, and Rashi's comment, or really we looked at all the Rishonim, classic commentaries, Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, and their approach to searching for a simple understanding of the text of Pshat, and that led us to Rashi, who is probably the most famous in terms of his attempt to balance, on the one hand, Pshat, on the other hand, his reliance on Midrash. And what we saw, based on the lessons and teachings of Nechama Leibowitz, was that even Rashi's quotations from Midrash, which we're most familiar with the world of Midrash from Rashi, even that is still kind of part of Rashi's attempt to understand the text, understand the Pshat, selectively quoting Midrashim, selectively moving Midrashim, applying them to places where he felt the text needed a deeper explanation just in terms of understanding Pshat. It's a much larger subject, but I kind of just gave you a brief introduction to it last week. Our subject today, next week, and really for the next 4 weeks, takes us in a somewhat different direction, and here we're going to start getting into the heart of the flip side of this, which is, up until now, we've dealt with the first half of the phrase, Midrashim don't necessarily have to be taken literally, and so we've analyzed that half. From here till the end of the course, we're going to flip that around to the second half of that statement, which is that they have to be taken seriously. And what I mean by that is, because we've had this kind of mindset of reading Midrashim superficially, we've kind of separated them from the world of Tanakh and said, okay, well, we're going to look at the text as a text, and we're going to leave Medrash and ignore it, right? Because Medrash is, in terms of interpretation of text, is not relevant. And what I want to share with you today, over the next couple of sessions, is a much more sophisticated way of looking at many, not all, but many Midrashic principles. Somebody just posted the notion of it's just Medrash, exactly. I mean, that's a mindset that I think we all have, especially when we're studying Tanakh, we're studying text, is we get to a quote and we say, oh, that's just a Medrash. But what I want to, we can't necessarily apply what I'm going to be sharing with you to every Medrash, but certainly as an approach, I think it's very valuable and it's very important to kind of balance these two areas. And so now I can go to screen sharing. Up until now, we've sort of taken the approach that I think is best articulated by the Rambam. This is one more source from that very first set of sources. But the Rambam, who in a number of places talks about Midrashim as Melitzot HaPiyutiyot, poetic language. The rabbi spoke in a language which was poetry, metaphor, riddles, and shaloshekachu inyanot ha'katuv, and not to imply that their rabbinic midrashic insight is in fact the simple reading of the value of the text, but rather, or the intent of the text, but rather more of a poetic or homiletic lesson. And that's been our principle up until now. What I want to share with you, and I think in the very first class I mentioned to you that there are two great influences on my study of Tanakh in my over the years. One, of course, who I mentioned was Nechama Leibowitz, Zichrona Livracha, and the other is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat HaRetzion, Rav Yaakov Meidan, whom I had the schus of studying Tanakh under or with for many years. And what I want to share with you is a basic thesis that I learned from Rav Meidan, and it appears in writing in a number of his articles. But we're going to take it and now begin to explore it on a much deeper, a broader scale. So this is a quote from one of Rav Meidan's articles, and I apologize, I looked for an English translation of this. I could not find it, so I will translate as I go. I'm only going to read parts of it, but he starts with what we've already established. Chazal enam misaprim sipurim, our sages are not storytellers. As much as we have a tendency today to publish books of Midrash just on the face literal value and call, you know, and as their own works, I have a aversion to doing that. I think that's a disservice to the rabbis and to the depth of what they have written. But nonetheless, that seems to be common today. Says Rav Meidan, the Chazal are not storytellers. If you take the rabbis' words in the Midrashic literature and you take them simply at a simple face value, that's foolish. On the other hand, Chazal ba'agadotahem af lo tifkidu kimavirei masorat k'tumot, our sages in their agadot, in their homiletic midrashim, are also not functioning as a kind of conduit to a tradition that goes back to Har Sinai, but rather, bikar kiparshanei mikra, they are engaged in a very sophisticated analysis of the text, commentary. And here is the thesis. Mikoro shel kol sipur chazal na'utz b'derach klal b'mikre mikra'i kadum or kodem. The source of Midrashic stories is, generally speaking, anchored in an earlier textual source in Tanakh. Meaning, now here at Vareinu, let's clarify. There are many places, Rav Meidan writes, Mekumot Rabim, where the text of Tanakh is vague or ambiguous in terms of details of an event. And our sages, Kipreshanei Mikra, our sages coming as commentary, are coming to fill in those gaps, to fill in the missing pieces of the story. Ba'u lefereshet ha-satum. And for that purpose, now listen to this very carefully, Yatzru agadot mashlimot ha-pa'arim. They created, in a kind of artistic literature, a yitzirah of these midrashic stories that fill in the gap. In this case, as in many cases, the question has to be asked, Alma mevusasima, are these words of our sages based? Why did they pick this story about Abraham, or that story about Yaakov? And they apply the principle known as, quote from Yerushalmi, Divrei Torah aniyim b'makom achad b'ashirim b'makom acher, the words of Torah are rich in one place and poor in another. And in all places where we have this gap or this missing information or this seemingly missing information, Chazal hishvu et hadmut o hanyan shaleihem medubar lesipur mikra'i makbil. Our sages took one story of Tanakh, one personality in Tanakh, and compared it to another parallel story or event in Tanakh, which is the bread and butter of modern Tanakh scholarship, which is to take parallel stories and look at them as parallel language parallels, thematic parallels, and to understand what we can derive from them. That is today in the Beis Medrash of Yeshivat HaRetzion, Michlal Herzog, or in the contemporary world of biblical scholarship, Yeshiva University and other places. That's what we do. When we study Tanakh, when we teach Tanakh, we take one story, we take another story of Tanakh, we compare them, we compare language, we compare style, and we derive lessons from those comparisons. Says Rav Meidan, and this is the core of his theory, of his thesis, this comparison, this textual and thematic link between stories and Tanakh. That's what gives, enriches this kind of filling in of the missing parts of the story. It's almost like a literary photomontage of pieces of Tanakh superimposed on others, like missing pieces of the puzzle. Now, that sounds very complicated. I'm going to simplify it for it. What Medan is arguing here, and it's the basis thesis, it's one of the most dramatic, creative ideas I have ever heard in the study of Medrash, and I have, since that moment when I first heard it from him, which was some 30 years ago, I have been keeping my eyes and ears peeled for examples of this theory, of Midrashic stories that are based on other biblical accounts that Chazal literally took, rewrote, and superimposed on other stories in order to give us indications and hints to link to links that give us deeper insight into both events. I'll give you a simple example, and then we'll get into a more sophisticated example. Here's a simple example. You've all heard the Midrashic statement, Rashi quotes in Chumash, that Pinchas hu Eliyahu, the identification of Pinchas and Eliyahu. Now, if I take that literally, it means that the biblical persona of Pinchas is alive and well in the story of Eliyahu HaNavi some 500 years later or so, or 400 years later, when Pinchas to Eliyahu is maybe 300 years. Okay? It means that Pinchas, by the time we get to save to the story of Malachim, end of Malachim Aleph, beginning of Malachim Bet, Pinchas is now some 300 years old. Now, I can take that literally and suggest that Pinchas is in fact Eliyahu. But I'm quite convinced, and that goes into the theme that we've been developing up until now, that Chazal never intended us to take that literally and to suggest that Pinchas, the story of Pinchas in Tanakh and Chumash, is the same as Eliyahu HaNavi, and that he's a soul that lived for 300 years and then went up to Shammai. Rather, what Chazal are doing is very simple, which is they recognize that there's a key characteristic of Pinchas that is expressed in a phrase the Torah uses to describe Pinchas. Namely, if you remember the story of Pinchas who killed Zimri and kind of was zealous in the beginning of Parshat Chukat, end of Parshat Chukat, beginning of Parshat Balak. Beginning of Parshat Pinchas, I should say. End of Parshat Balak. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen Shivat Chamati Mi'al B'nei Yisrael. Pinchas ben Elazar was the one who turned my wrath away from the children of Israel. Bikano et kinati, when he was zealous for me, zealous or jealous, and took action when nobody else would, and thereby enabled v'lochilitiyat b'nei Yisrael b'kinati, that I didn't consume Israel because of my zealousness and jealousy in the story of Benot Midya. That's the pasuk, Pinchas, and that's why we call Pinchas a kanoi, who is a zealot. If you look at Eliyahu, one of Eliyahu's most dramatic moments in the story of Eliyahu after his events in Har Carmel is he comes to the cave where Moshe Rabbeinu had his vision of the Midot HaRachamim, of the characteristics of God's mercy, and God says to Malach HaPo, Eliyahu, what are you doing here? And Eliyahu proclaims, Vayomer, Kano kineti LaHashem Elokei Tzvaot, I was zealous for you, God, because Israel abandoned your covenant, because they've destroyed you, they've killed you, the prophets, and they have killed by the sword, and they've left me alone, I'm the last one left. In other words, Eliyahu is known as a kanoi. Now, Eliyahu's kanaut, Eliyahu's zealotry, is well known. It's well documented. The whole story of Eliyahu, who starts with a war against Achab by declaring a drought in the land of Israel because he's zealous for the idolatry of the land in that's taking place, etc., gives Eliyahu a character trait that is shared with Pinchas, namely the kanoi. And so by Chazal saying Pinchas Eliyahu, they're not suggesting that Pinchas is in fact 300 years old when he gets to the story of Eliyahu, but they are suggesting that there's a common theme in the story of Pinchas to the story of Eliyahu. Now that common theme works both ways. It works positively to describe the Pinchas, the great Pinchas, who was zealous for God, Eliyahu, the great prophet, zealous for God, but it also works negatively, because ultimately Pinchas' zealotry is his own undoing. And we don't see that until you look at Sefer Shoftim, where Pinchas appears again, and he appears again in a context in which, and please God, if we have time, Mr. Hashem, and the rest of this material, there's a further analysis of the story next week. But Pinchas' own zealotry gets him into trouble in Sefer Shoftim. Well, Eliyahu's own zealotry also gets him into trouble. And it's almost as if the Torah's message is, as much as zealotry has a place, it is not an ideal and it doesn't have a place in leadership, and therefore the failure of Eliyahu in his application of zealotry is also the failure in the context of Pinchas. And so by three words, Pinchas u Eliyahu, Chazal link two anchor points in the story of Tanakh and say to us, what you're seeing here is similar to what you're seeing here and vice versa. And now go and analyze the two personalities, the two stories, the two events, and see what other lessons we can learn from them. So that's exactly what Rav Medan is describing. That's a very simple example. We're going to get to more sophisticated ones, where the notion is that many of these midrashic stories or insights are built around text in Tanakh that we don't necessarily know or see on the face of it. And Chazal are helping us unravel that mystery. Now, I will tell you one additional piece of information before we move forward, and that is that I am quite convinced that the reason this works in Midrash is because Chazal took as an assumption that we were as familiar with the books of Tanakh as they were. Chazal knew Tanakh by heart, without question. They knew every pasuk in Tanakh by heart. And the proof to that is, if anybody's ever studied a page of Talmud, and you get to a point in a passage in the Talmud where the Gemara quotes a verse, and very often the lesson the Gemara wants to derive from that verse is not in the part that's quoted, but in the continuation of the verse, or two verses later, or the context of the chapter as a whole. Because Chazal assumed if they quote half a verse, we know the rest. Chazal certainly knew Tanakh by heart. They assumed we did too. And so when they paint these pictures and draw these connect-the-dots kinds of insights, they're assuming we are, to us it's self-explanatory. And that's part of the problem, is that we've lost that depth of understanding, and therefore we've lost to a large extent the significance, the key to unlocking the mystery of these midrashic insights. All right, enough theory, let's talk tachlis. I want to start actually with what is undoubtedly the most famous midrashic story in all of midrashic literature, and at the same time the classic example to this theory. And that is the story of Avraham in the furnace, being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod, or Avraham's fight with his father's idols. If ask most people who aren't really well versed in the story of Bereshit, how Abraham's story begins, and they'll tell you that Abraham's fight with his father's idols and destroys his father's idols, and his father brings him to Nimrod, and Nimrod throws him into the furnace, and there's an angel comes and saves him, etc. All of that is the beginning of the story of Abraham. Surprise, surprise, none of that is in Tanakh. And so the question, so this is one of those classic midrashic stories, and I'm going to read it in English for the sake of time. The Hebrew or the Aramaic appears here. Haran died in the presence of his father Terach, that's the pasuk in Bereshit. Rabbi Chiya said, Terach was a manufacturer of idols. Now, just right there, let's stop for 1 second. Terach obed slamimaya. Terach was an idolater. How do we know that Terach worshipped idols? Let's start from the basic question. There's an assumption here. Terach worshipped idols. Where in Sefer Bereishit does it tell me that Terach worshipped idols? The story of Terach, the first time it's he's mentioned in the context of taking Abraham and his family from Haran to the land of Canaan. From Ur Kasdim to the land of Canaan, he stops in Haran, and Terach and Abraham continues the journey, the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha. We know nothing about Terach in Sefer Bereishit. Nothing. So where do we get the notion that Terach is a manufacturer of idols? Now, it could be a pure Midrashic creation. On the other hand, if I know, as I think Chazal did and assumed we did, all of Tanakh by heart, then we are immediately recognize a verse which is not on your source page. I apologize, I added this later, but it is on your source page. I lied. If you go down to Yeshua Perakov Dalid, we find the very last chapter of Sefer Yehoshua. Vayomer Yehoshua Kolam, Yehoshua is giving a history lesson to the people. And he says to them, Komer Hashem Elokei Yisrael, thus says Hashem God of Israel, Ve'eva nar yeshvu avotechem me'olam, Terach avi Avraham, our forefathers dwelt beyond the river. Terach, father of Abraham, Vavi Nachor, Vayavdu Elohim Acherim, and they worshipped idols. And I took Abraham and I brought him to the land of Israel, and the rest of the story is history. So here I have a pasuk, that tells me that Terach was part of a milieu and a culture that worshipped idols. That's the only source to it in all of Tanakh.
The Book of Jubilees gives you the exact story.
The Book of Jubilees is not part of the canon of the Bible. The Book of Jubilees is not, Sefer Yovlim is not part of the 24 books of Tanakh. And I'm working only with the 24 books of Tanakh. I'm not working with any part of the Apocrypha or the New Testament or any other books that are not part of the canon of the 24 books of the Bible. Most of those stories, for example, the Book of the Jubilee that gives that story, is building off the Midrash rather than the other way around. So I appreciate the insight, but so that in Tanakh, however, in the 24 books of Tanakh, that's the only source. So Chazal come along and say, "Tikkun is a given." Terach Oved Shlamim Hayah. How do I know? Because we know that there was a verse in Sefer Yehoshua that told me so. Then the Medrash goes on to tell the following story. He once went away somewhere and he left Abraham to sell them in his place. A man came in and wished to buy one. So he said to him, "How old are you?" Abraham asked the man. And the man said, "He's 50. And Abraham responded and said, "Woe to such a man who's 50 years old and he would worship an object that's only a day old." And the man walked out. On another occasion, a woman came in with a plate full of flour. And she said to him, "Take this and offer it to the idols." So Abraham took a stick and he broke the idols. And then he put the stick in the hand of the largest idol. And when his father came back, his father said, "What have you done?" And Abraham said, "I cannot conceal it from you. A woman came with a plate full of fine meal, requested me to offer it to one of these idols. And one of these idols proclaimed, 'I have to eat first.' And the other idol proclaimed, 'I will eat first.' Whereupon the largest arose, he took the stick, and he broke all the other idols. To which his father said, 'Why do you make fun of me? Have you any have these idols any knowledge? They're stick and stone.' Terach said, to which Abraham responded and said, 'Let your ears hear what your mouth has said.'" Part 1. Part 2. Thereupon Terach seized him and delivered him to Nimrod. And Nimrod begins a whole conversation with Abraham. "Let's worship fire," says Nimrod. Says Abraham, "Let's worship water that quenches fire." Said Nimrod, "Let us worship water." Said Abraham, "Let's worship the clouds which bring the water." Nimrod said, "Let us worship the clouds." And Abraham responded, "Let's worship the wind that disperses the clouds." At which point, this goes on and on and on. And finally, Nimrod says, "We serve fire, we will cast you into the fire, and let your God, whom you adore, come and save you from it." And the rest, as we know, is history. He's miraculously saved. So I've separated this into two parts. Okay? I'm going to just zoom out for a second. I've separated this medrash into two parts. Part 1, Abraham destroys his father's idols. Part 2, Abraham is thrown into the furnace of Nimrod and is miraculously saved as part of his early origins and faith in God. Okay. Both of these halves of this story, of this Midrash, are biblical events. They are both rooted in other biblical accounts. And that's the theory of Rav Meidan. And this is actually the article around which Rav Meidan wrote this theory, but we'll see it in many examples. If I was to say to you, and the problem here is that we need to know all 24 books of Tanakh in order to properly process what this Medrash is saying. And if we don't have a grasp of the book of Shoftim, or the book of Daniel, or the book of Malachim, or any of these other books of Tanakh, then we miss a big piece of what Chazal are trying to convey. And that's part of what my whole philosophy in trying to express and to teach this material is to recognize that Chazal are not telling stories. They are drawing insights. They are playing a very sophisticated game of connect the dots. The question is, what dots are they trying to connect? So if I said to you, okay, Nimrod. Who is Nimrod? What do we know about Nimrod? Wait a second, how is Nimrod in this story? Abraham and Nimrod never have a conversation with each other. Where does Nimrod come from? Okay, the answer is, if you look at Bereshit, you'll see that in Bereshit chapter 10, it says that Nimrod was a Gibor Ba'aretz. This is in Parshat Noach, so this is right before Lech Lecha. And he was a Gibor Tzayid, he was a mighty hunter. And Vatei Reshit Mamlachto Bavel, and the beginning of his kingdom was in Bavel, Erech Akkad, Kalnei, in the land of Shinar. Okay, so now I have a little bit of an understanding of who Nimrod is. He's a king, beginning of his kingdom. He's a warrior. He's a king. And his kingdom is in the land of Bavel. Eretz Shinar, Bavel. Okay. So if I said to you, wait a second, a story in Bavel and or the land of Shinar with a fiery furnace and a test of faith into which a person who is loyal to God is thrown in order to, as a kind of a challenge to his faith, and then he is miraculously saved, you would say that's the story of Abraham in the furnace of Nimrod in Bavel. And I would say to you, no.
Daniel.
What I just described to you is the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar in the land of Bavel in Sefer Daniel. In other words, the story exists. The story exists in Tanakh. It's in Sefer Daniel, as somebody correctly just pointed out. And it's remarkably similar, but that's not a coincidence. And here's the story in Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Bavel, spoke and said to these three individuals by the names of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which are their Babylonian names, that do you not serve my gods, not worship the golden image that I have set up? If you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn and the pipe, etc., you will bow down and worship this image which I have made, and if not, I will throw you into the burning fiery furnace. Daniel chapter 3. And the God who shall say, and who is the God who will save you from my hands? And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If it be so that our God whom we serve is able to save us from the fiery furnace, he will save us. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods nor worship the golden image which you have set up. In other words, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah go into the furnace not knowing that they're going to be saved. They go into the furnace as an act of faith with God, and they said loyalty to God, not faith, loyalty. And if they don't survive, so be it. Which, if you read between the lines in the original story of the Medrash, is exactly the difference between Abraham and Nimrod. Abraham and Nahor. The Medrash here identifies that Abraham's brother, Nahor, was standing there not Nochor, Haran. He was standing there, and he said, "Well, if Abraham saved, then I'll say my fate is with Abraham, and if Abraham dies, then I'll say my fate is with Nimrod." And it doesn't work for Haran the way it works for Abraham. Right? That notion that Abraham's loyalty is not based on the assumption that he'll be saved, but rather just a loyalty to God, that too is in the story in Daniel. And then, of course, the rest of the story we know. They're thrown into the furnace, and the Malach comes and saves them. So the story of Abraham in the furnace is essentially a rework of the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the furnace of Nebuchadnezzar. It's even the same place. It's the same location. It's Babel and Shinar. It's Nimrod, who is the king of Babel in the days of Abraham, and Nebuchadnezzar in the days of Daniel. Now, the real question that has to be asked is, it's clear that Chazal recognized the story in Daniel and reworked it into a story by Abraham. The only question is why? And that's a question we're going to address momentarily. Because that's the key question. What are they trying to do? Why did they literally copy and paste a story of from Sefer Daniel into the backdrop or the background of the story of Abraham? But there's another part of the story as well, right? The Smedrash is comprised of two events. The first one of these is the furnace of Nimrod. The other was that Abraham's journey begins with an act of defiance against the idols of his father. And so Abraham's beginning, sort of the origin story, if you will, in the language of modern movies, right? The origin story of Abraham is Abraham breaks his father's idols, and then his story begins. That too has its roots in a biblical account, not by Abraham, but by somebody else, namely. So I'm going to jump from Daniel. First, we'll come back to Daniel in a minute. But we're going to jump to Shoftim. Chapter 6 of the book of Shoftim. God came to Gideon, and he says to him, "You are going to save Israel from the hands of the Midianites." But God said to him, first, you have a job to do. God said to him, take this ox that is your father's ox. Gideon's father was an idol worshiper. And first destroy your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah tree, the idolatry tree that is next to it. And build an altar to God, and upon it bring these sacrifices. In other words, the story in Sefer Shoftim, if you remember the story where he has to go to war against an entire army of Midian, and he's got an army of 30,000, God says, you're not going to war with 30,000 soldiers, because if you do, you'll say that you were victorious because of the strength of your own hands. And he whittles, the various ways, he whittles down this army to 300 soldiers. And he says, with these 300, you're going to go to war against the tens of thousands of Midianite soldiers. And the whole story unfolds in chapter 6 and 7 of Sefer Shoftim. But that story begins where Gideon is told he has to first destroy his father's altar to Baal, which he doesn't want to do by day because he's afraid of what they'll do, and so he does it at night. And eventually, because he destroyed the altar of Baal, he's given a nickname of Yiru Baal, of the one who fought against Baal. So here I have a story in Tanakh of an individual who's the leader of his people, who is the shofet, who will lead his people into battle, with a small army and not a great army, against many, many, many thousands more in number, as a demonstration of God, loyalty to God's power. And we're told that his story has to begin with a destroying of his father's altar and idolatry. So Chazal took that story and superimposed it on the backdrop to Abraham. Abraham's story also must begin with the destruction of the altar, the idolatry of his father. In other words, the story is comprised of two pieces that are based on two different accounts in Tanakh, but they both exist in Tanakh. It's just the sophisticated process of connecting the dots between the stories. So the to understand the methodology, the first question we have to ask is, why? What do I gain by this kind of sophisticated connect the dots? So let's briefly talk about Avram in the furnace, or the story of the Nile. So on the one hand, I could easily say that it's simply a matter of Abraham's faith in God, in a world or milieu of idolatry, is exactly the same kind of test that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had, loyal to God in a milieu of idolatrous culture, especially in the diaspora, which Daniel is the first generation of Jews living in Bavel after the destruction of the temple. And the same way that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's loyalty to God was unshakable, even though they were living in an idolatrous milieu in a foreign country, that strength must be similar to what it must have been like for Abraham to be loyal to God in a milieu where everybody around him was idolatrous. So on that level, I could understand the story by itself. But I think there's a much deeper, more sophisticated connection here. And it starts with the recognition of understanding the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In other words, sometimes it works backwards. It's not about telling us about Abraham yet as much as it's telling us about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Namely, what was the statue? This is chapter 3 of Daniel. I just finished sort of teaching Sefer Daniel in my community, so we're kind of in the midst of this discussion. But what was the statue? So if you look at the sequence of chapter 2, chapter 3, and chapter 4 of Daniel, the statue is a fascinating piece of the story. Because in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream about a statue that looks like him, that is made up of various types of metals, gold, silver, copper, brass, and stone, that comes and destroys it. And the message to him is that his kingdom is limited and it will be destroyed. In the next chapter, in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar responds by building an entire statue made of pure gold, as if to say, Bavel is going to endure forever, and that I am going to be king, and my kingdom will last forever, and not be made up of different metals that represent different eras of history. And in chapter 4, he has a vision where he walks up to the top of his palace, and he says, "Halo zoi Bavel Agdola asher ani b'niti alevet malchut betokef chosliu lechvod adari." This is my Bavel. I'm looking out at my kingdom from the top, from the palace, from the rooftop of this tower of Bavel, and I see all of Bavel that I have built with the might of my hand and the honor and the power of my majesty. And while the words were still in Nebuchadnezzar's mouth, a voice came from heaven and said, "Nebuchadnezzar, this kingdom is taken away from you, and you shall be driven from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the fields, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox for 7 seasons, to demonstrate that there's a power even greater than you." That, in a nutshell, is the first 3 chapters of Sefer Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, who sets himself up as a power king, unparalleled in the world. This is my Bavel. I built it. I am king over the entire humanity at the time, all of civilization, and God comes to cut him down literally to size. And that's the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In the midst of this, Nebuchadnezzar's great plan that his golden statue that stood 60 cubits high that will demonstrate the loyalty, the power of Bavel, I've got 3 Jews who stood up and said, there's a power greater than you, namely God. Okay? That's the story. Now, I know another moment in history where there was a great tower built in the land of Bavel. And in this great tower, there was a king who stood at the top of this tower and proclaimed himself king over all of humanity. Namely, Tower of Bavel. The Tower of Bavel is exactly the same story. Look at the Tower of Bavel is in Bereshit Yud Aleph, which is the next chapter I showed you before, chapter 10, which is Nimrod. In the story of Nimrod's kingdom, in chapter 11, we start, Vayikol Aretz Safa Achat Udvarim Achadim, the entire world was of one language and one speech. And they got together in the valley of Shinar, in the land of Bavel, and they began to build a city and a tower. And God comes to disrupt this tower. And everybody wonders, what did the people do wrong? They built a tower up to heavens. Why did God get so angry at them? And Rashi is his interpretation, etc. I want to share with you the Sforno. It's extraordinary. The Sforno says, Zu aita atzat sarei ador. This was the generation, the story of the leaders of the generation. This was their idea. Lamlich et Nimrod al kol amin ha'enoshi. To crown Nimrod king over the entire human race. Nimrod is the king of Bavel. The tower is a palace. And everybody would look up to that tower. And who would stand at the top of that tower, looking down at his kingdom and saying, this is Bavel that I built to my majesty and glory? Nimrod. And you've heard the expression that we refer to God as Melech Malchei HaMelechim, right? God is King of Kings. Why don't we refer to God as King of Kings? Why do we have three phrases there? Melech, Malchei HaMelechim. What happened to Melech HaMelechim? Why don't we just refer to God as King of Kings? And the answer is that because if you look at Sefer Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar refers to himself as a king of an empire, a king of kings. And so if you elevate God one step above Nebuchadnezzar, you've got to expand it. So God is the king of the king of kings. So hence the phrase that has become part of the liturgy of Jewish life, Melech Malchei HaMelechim. That's exactly what was going on in the Tower of Bavel. Now, so here's what I have. I have the Tower of Bavel on the one hand, which is the story of Nimrod's attempt to become king of all of humanity. And I have the story of Nebuchadnezzar on the other hand, and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Why is it relevant to Abraham? It's a triangle. Because this story is the last story of Sefer of Parshat Noach, and the next verse, which you don't have here in the text, but the next verse is the beginning of the story of Abraham. And the Tower of Bavel serves as the backdrop to the story of Abraham in the text. So much so that in the fascinating Medrash, in Bereshit Rabbah, the Medrash asks the question, how old was Abraham when he recognized God? And there are two opinions. We're familiar with the second opinion, that he was 3 years old, questioning who started the world, etc. But the other opinion in the Medrash is that he was 48 years old when he discovered God. And you have to ask the question, why 48? Where does that number come from? Well, the answer is, Avram is exactly 48 years old at the time of the Tower of Bavel, if you go through the chronology of Sefer Bereshit. He's standing and watching the events of the Tower of Bavel, and he sees He sees Nimrod unite all of humanity by conquest, by the fact that he's a Gibor Tzayin, that he's a warrior. And he says, and he unites all of humanity into one unified kingdom, all serve the king of Bavel. And then he sees a power more powerful than Nimrod come and take him down, and he realizes that there's a God who's a king of kings. And so it's the story of God's intervention in history that transforms Abraham and gives him the faith to recognize God in the world. That's the story. That's why the Tower of Bavel serves as the backdrop to the story of Abraham in the text. This is the triangle the Chazal draw for us by taking the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the furnace of Nebuchadnezzar and saying, oh, that's what happened to Abraham in the furnace of Nimrod. Nimrod, Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, Bavel, Tower, and suddenly I have a triangle that gives me a whole new insight into Abraham, into Nimrod, into Sefer Bereshit, into everything that's taking place. That's the power of a Midrash. If we recognize that the Midrash is designed to link two stories in our minds, the story upon which it's written and the story from whence it comes. But for that, we need to know or be familiar with both. Okay, so I've given you essentially a snapshot of one shiur, which is the article written by Rav Medan in his book on Sefer Bereishit that develops this theory. And what I want to share with you now for the remainder of today and then next week are a collection of other examples over the span of Tanakh and the span of Midrash that are all based on the same methodology. Namely, I have a Medrash Chazal in one place in Chumash or in Nach, that if we understand that all 24 books of Tanakh are one unit, and we can draw from any of them, suddenly we realize that there's a great depth to each of these stories. We have to know the story from which it comes and the story on which it is applicable. So let's briefly do the second example, which is Shoftim Perek Vav, this chapter of Gidon. And I suggested to you that Gidon's destroying of the idols of his father is the backdrop that Chazal used to create the other half of that Midrashic story, namely, Abraham destroying the idols of his father. It creates a parallel in our minds between the story of Gidon and the story of Abraham. So that medrash should, if we understand it correctly, conjure in our minds the notion and say, okay, well, Gidon destroyed his father's idols or altar. Chazal is telling us that Abraham, quote-unquote, did the same thing. That means that Chazal is telling us to understand Avraham, we need to see the story of Gidon, or vice versa, to see the story of Gidon, we need to see the story of Avraham. Well, what do they have in common? What do Gidon and Avraham have in common? I'm going to stop sharing for a second. What do Gidon and Avraham have in common? I can tell you one thing they have in common. Gidon's most famous moment was a battle against thousands of Midianite soldiers, where he went to war not with an army of 30,000, but God whittled it down to an army of 300. And if you remember the story, he had to give a torch to each one and on the horse and a pitcher and make noise, and they kind of all attacked from different sides of Midian, and Midian thought that each one was the head of a platoon rather than an individual soldier, and they fled. 300 could destroy an entire army. Well, does that not tell me something about Avraham? Do we know any story about Avraham where he goes to war with approximately 300 people to go to war against massive armies of kings and chariots and horses and warriors and armies and kings and alliances? And we wonder, how could 318 people that Avraham took into a battle against the four kings be victorious? How could you do that? Is that real? Are we for real? Are we suggesting that Avraham and 318 people went to war against the entire combined forces of four kings? The answer is yes. If Gidon could do it, so could Avraham. And suddenly the whole story of Avraham's battle against Kedorlaomer and his forces takes on a whole new meaning if we see it against the backdrop of Avraham's battle. Against the backdrop of Gidon's battle against Midian. And there are many other comparisons between Gidon and Avraham that I'm going to skip for now, but I think you get the message. The whole idea is that these Midrashic stories are there to conjure in our minds an association. And from that association, we now begin to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And it gives us insight in both directions. All right. I'm going to move into a second example of this kind of genre, and let's look at this story. Okay. So here's a medrash. Rashi quotes this, the beginning of the story of the Akedah. It's Gemara in Sanhedrin. And the medrash says the following. After these things, God tested Abraham. This is the beginning of the story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah. What is after these things? After what things are we talking about? My achar, says Rav Yochanan in the name of Rabbi Yosi ben Zimra, after the words of the Satan. As it says, Ve'igdal ha'yeled ve'igamal, the child was weaned, and Abraham weaned him, and he made a great feast, Abraham Mishtegadol, in the day that he weaned Yitzchak. Says the Satan before Kadosh Baruch Hu. Amar Satan lifnei Kadosh Baruch Hu. Yibono shel Olam. Zaken zeh, this old man. Chinanto lemea shana pribatan. You gave him at the age of 100. You gave him a child. And in this whole feast that he has created, mikol suda shesalo, lo ayalo torachad or gazal achad lakriv lefanecha, couldn't bring you one offering, one pigeon, one turtle dove, you couldn't sacrifice to you? Amalo, to which God said to the Satan, klumasa ele b'shu b'no. Sorry, this is, he had said this he had done for his son. I know that if I said to Abraham, sacrifice your son, he would do it. He's so loyal. God says to the Satan. And to prove it, God tested Abraham and he said, Kach nat bincha. And the Medrash sets up the entire story of the Akedah as an answer, proof, between God and the Satan. God wants to prove to the Satan that Abraham's loyalty is unquestionable. That's the Medrash. Rashi quotes at the beginning of Parashat Vayera. Now I ask you, the Satan, as God conversing with the Satan, and the entire test of Abraham and the Akedah is nothing more than an appeasement of the Satan, a way of God answering and proving to the Satan that the Satan is wrong? I'm flabbergasted. We quote this Medrash all the time. What does it mean? Well, do we know any story in Tanakh that begins with a conversation between God and the Satan? And that ends with a test of the loyalty of the righteous follower of God?
Eov.
It's exactly the story of Eov. That is exactly the opening passage of Sefer Eov. And I quote it. The sons of God, whoever they are, came to present themselves before God, and Satan came amongst them. And God said to the Satan, this is in Tanakh. This is in Tanakh. Where are you coming from? And the Satan answers, Mishut Baretz, I've come from exploring, from touring the ground, the earth. God says to the Satan, have you paid attention to my servant Eov? And come on, Baretz, there's none like him. Ishtam, he is loyal like Yaakov, Yashar, straight, Yirei Elokim like Abraham, fears God, Sar Meira, refuses to, turns away from evil. What a wonderful servant Eov. So the Satan says, wait a second. Eov fears God because he's got a good life. It's not for naught. Ata sachta ba'do ba'ad beto ba'ad kol ha'shalom misaviv. You have not protected him and given him a house and his family and wealth, etc. You've blessed him, merachta, mikneu, paratz, and he's wealthy. Of course he's going to serve you. He's got a great. Says the Satan to God, Shlach na yadcha vega b'chol ha'shalom, lo panecha yivarcheka. Now see, if you put forth your hand and destroy all that he has and watch him turn his blessing into curse. Vayomer Hashem al ha'satan, God said to the Satan, Hine kol ha'shalom b'yadecha rak elav al tishlach yadecha v'yetze ha'satan me'im p'nei Hashem. So God says to the Satan, okay, you want the bet? You're on. You can do this, Eov, whatever you want, you just can't kill him. And let's see what happens to him. 42 chapters later, Eov is a broken man. Eov is destroyed. His family is destroyed. His wealth is gone. His status is gone. And he cries, spends the entire book crying out to God, yelling at God, arguing with God. Okay? That's Eov. Why on earth would I put the story of Eov into the background of Avram and the Akedah? So first of all, there's a textual parallel. And so on a very simple level, I have a moment in which Chazal are telling me there's a textual connection between them. And there's a very famous phrase that Avraham uses when he's arguing on behalf of the people of Sodom. He argues with God and he says, V'anochi afar v'efra, I am dust and ashes. Eov spends 42 chapters arguing with God. Avraham had one chapter, one moment we argued with God. He said, I am but dust and ashes, but I'm still going to argue with God. Eov argues with God for 40 chapters. Twice in Sefer Eov, he describes himself as being of dust and ashes. I abhor my life, I relent my life, for I am but dust and ashes. The only time the phrase Afava Efer appears in all of Tanakh is twice in Eov and once by Avraham. So already there's a textual connection the Chazal are pointing out. But the story is connected. The story of Eov is a test. The story of Avraham is a test. This medrash I'm going to skip for now, but there's a really unbelievable medrash that Rashi quotes a piece of it in the beginning when Avraham is traveling to the Akedah 3 days. And the Medrash says that the Satan appeared to Avraham in various ways to stop him, like a river, etc. And the argument that the Satan poses to Avraham is that if he goes through with this, he'll be alone. All of his followers will abandon him. That Medrash is also built around the story of Eov, because Eov's whole angst, his pain, is in the fact that his friends have abandoned him. And that in his pain and in his suffering, the loneliness is ultimately what destroys him. So you have to ask the question, why did Chazal take the story of Eov and put it into the backdrop of the story of Avraham? Well, take a look at this Yerushalmi. Emet haya Eov. When was Eov? When did the story of Eov take place? So you know there's an opinion in the Gemara that Eov, the entire book of Eov is a literary creation. It's a mashal, it's a parable, and it didn't actually happen. There is such an opinion in Chazal that he is a mashal. Nonetheless, the Yerushalmi takes a different approach and quotes the opinion of Ish Lakish, who says that Eov lived at the time of Avraham. It's based on a reference to the fact that Eov comes from the land of Uz, and Uz is mentioned in Sefer Bereishit as one of the nations at the time, the descendants of Esav. Furthermore, the Gemara in Baba Basra that says, Chasid haya b'umot ha'olam ve'Eov shmo, there was one pious man amongst the heathens, his name was Eov. He was not Jewish, he was a Gentile. V'lo ba li'olam ela kedei lekabel shcharo, and he came into this world only to receive a reward. God gave him many tests and chastisements, etc., and he began to curse God. That stands in contrast to Avraham, who was tested with 10 different tests, and he withstood them all, and he never questioned God. In other words, and this is really the extraordinary piece of it. What does Chazal recognize? Avraham has no origin story. But I do have in Tanakh a contemporary account of somebody who was tested by God and who failed in that test because he challenged God. He argued with God. And he argued with God for his own benefit. Avraham also argues with God. But he argues with God not for his own benefit, but for the benefit of the people of Sdom. And what Chazal are telling us in this moment is, especially if I look at Eov, whether he lived in the time of Avraham or his story is contemporary to Avraham, what Chazal essentially saying is, if you want to understand what makes Avraham special and why he was chosen, all you need to do is look at the story of Eov. Tested in the same manner that Avraham was tested, Eov failed and Avraham succeeded. Eov complained and Avraham accepted. Eov challenged God. Avraham accepted God. Fundamentally different. But I start by taking the beginning of the introduction of Eov and putting it into the background of the story of Avraham in order to link the two in my mind. In other words, what I'm suggesting to you, I'm going to stop here, is there's a methodology involved in these midrashim. And the methodology is to take a story of Tanakh that is connected to a different story and link them by creating a literary device called the Midrashic story, pulled from one part of Tanakh and superimposed on the other. And in our minds, we are expected to be so familiar with the world of Tanakh that we immediately draw the connection. And now we begin a much more sophisticated analysis of what those two stories have in common, how they connect, how they link, what they share, what they can teach, what the differences are, and what one can teach to the other. And there are many such examples. We're for sure familiar with them, and we're going to touch on some of them next week. But for example, just to throw out a few, how many of you have heard the story, just by raise of hand, how many of you have heard the story that of how Moshe was chosen? Moshe goes looking for the lost sheep, and God says, oh, somebody who cares that much about my sheep should be the leader of Israel. Right? You've all heard that, Medrash. That story appears in Tanakh. That story appears in Tanakh, not by Moshe, but by Shaul, who goes looking for his father's lost donkey and ends up encountering Shmuel, who tells him he's going to be the first king of Israel. I have no doubt that Chazal pulled one story to enhance the other. And so on and so forth. So we're going to look at a number of these examples and what they teach us. But each one is a mini shiur. You understand that each one of these examples opens up a whole analysis that requires a shiur into itself. We're going to do a grave injustice by doing snippets of those shiurim in order to kind of pull many of these examples together in a depth of knowledge, a depth of examples of this theory. So, for now, I'm going to stop here. I'm not going to have time for today for questions. However, if you have questions, write them down. Either email them to me, or I'll get on the call next week 15 minutes early. You're welcome to join me, and we'll have a chance to continue this conversation, the kind of a Q&A that we can do at that time.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it.
Very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Shulman. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.
Be sure to check out our program schedule for upcoming shiurim. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you very much. Wonderful shiur.